I'm Brandon Sedloff, the host of the Distribution Podcast. I've been humbled by your support. Every day, I get emails, text messages, LinkedIn messages from listeners around the world. I started this podcast a little over a year and a half ago as a way to codify and share interesting conversations that I'm having with industry leaders across private markets. I figured I'm very fortunate that I get to have these conversations, and every time I learn so much, so I might as well hit record, create a platform so that I can share the learnings with all of you. None of this would be possible without the support of Juniper Square. For the last 10 years, Juniper Square has been powering the investment operations of private markets across real estate, private equity, venture capital, crypto, and more. And Juniper Square's earned the trust of more than 2,000 investment managers around the world that we support with a global team of nearly 600 across our fund administration and technology businesses. If you have a fund that you're thinking about launching, have a fund administrator that you work with that's not meeting your needs, or maybe you just want to learn more about what it would look like to outsource some of these functions for the very first time, but you also want to ensure that you're maximizing the efficiency of your business and you're creating a leading world-class experience for your investors, then drop me a line, brandon_thedistribution@junipersquare.com, and I'll personally make sure a member of our team gets in touch. Thank you for listening and for your support of this podcast, and enjoy the episode.
The question is, do you believe that technology will represent more of GDP in the future? And do you believe that technology companies will outperform non-technology companies because of their ability to both scale and leverage AI to be more efficient and manage the bottom line? Like some of those basic principles, I think, are universally agreed and really help you orient to, do I want more exposure to tech?
Welcome to The Distribution by Juniper Square. I'm your host, Brandon Sedloff. On today's episode, I sit down with Megan Reynolds, partner and head of capital formation and talent at Altimeter, a leading technology-focused investment firm. We discuss Megan's impressive career, the operating ethos of Altimeter, and some of the trends driving public and private technology companies. With AI and technology top of everybody's mind, this is a great opportunity to learn from one of the preeminent investors in the space. Let's get into it. Megan, welcome to the show. I'm thrilled to have you.
Brandon, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm really excited about this podcast. I have a lot to learn. I'm really curious. For our guests that don't know you, let's talk a little bit about your career. You've been in the alt space around capital formation for over 20 years. Maybe take us back to the beginning. How did you get into the industry? You know, what did you do when you started your career, and kind of what was it that attracted you to alts?
Yeah, thank you so much for that question. It's fun to go in the way back machine and think all the way back to, you know, graduating from college. I graduated from Notre Dame in 2001. And, you know, I think people say it's better to be lucky than right. And I was lucky on that timing for a number of reasons. You know, it sounds unlucky because the internet bubble had burst. You know, it was actually a tough job market to start in. I started my career right before 9/11. And so, you know, it was a tricky time, but super lucky because it was really the advent of alts and private equity as an institutional asset class. And I landed there purely by accident. I was very lucky. I got my job at Goldman Sachs through a connection. I was a good student, and I think I worked really hard and put myself in the right position. But the reality is I grew up in a small town in New Jersey at the Jersey Shore. And after school, every day I would work at a women's clothing store, a little boutique, which was run by a woman who had eight sisters. And her oldest sister was a managing director at Goldman Sachs in the asset management division. And I worked hard as a salesperson in this little clothing boutique. And she said, you know what, she knew I was studying finance, and she put me in touch with her sister, who luckily kind of put me in the right place at the right time, which in this little group called the Private Equity Group, which was this little tiny kind of startup group within Goldman Sachs Asset Management in the investment management division. And they were starting an institutional fund of funds kind of on their way to bringing introducing institutions to private equity as an asset class, which was not a standard across the board. I mean, this is when, you know, endowments were there, but pensions, insurance companies, high net worth individuals, they had no allocation to private equity or venture. In fact, a lot of what I worked on in early days was something called Private Equity University. It was teaching major institutions about what private equity was and why it had a role to play in an institutional allocation. So that's, you know, where I rolled in on the street. And over the next 9 years, I spent my career at Goldman, helped build that business. I was staffed on a fundraise pretty early on, again, being lucky, and never left that side of the business. For me, fundraising was this great combination of knowing the technical sides of the business, talking about deals and markets, but relationship building and content and writing and that well-rounded nature of the role really spoke to me. And I loved getting to travel all over the world, meeting really intelligent people and managers that were doing incredible things and being able to talk about what they were building, whether it was on the innovative side of venture or large buyout transactions and everything in between. So 9 years at Goldman. In 2010, I was recruited to join TPG as they were really building out their institutional franchise and how they approached their client base and how they built out, you know, their product set. And that's funny to say, they were already a $40 billion firm. Weren't they really institutionalized already? But the reality was they'd grown really fast and had very few people that were focused on covering clients and building out products. This was right after the, you know, kind of still in the midst of the financial crisis, as they were, you know, a lot of institutions were struggling with what the right allocation to private equity was. It was a hard time to fundraise at the same time that TPG wanted to build out multiple products. They wanted to expand in credit and real estate and growth equity. And so it was a really fun and interesting time to be building that platform. It grew from $40 billion to $120 billion in assets in the 10 years that I was there. And now today I'm sitting with Altimeter and joined Altimeter at a really interesting time where, you know, everything in ventures and in tech public markets, it's turned on its head right after I got there, but couldn't be more interesting in terms of product set, problem solving, innovation, and, you know, a lot of the same issues that LPs were struggling with when I joined TPG are the same things they're struggling with now on the venture side. And so it's fun for me to be applying that knowledge and skill set in the context of a venture and public market strategy.
Wow. That's an awesome overview. There's a lot to unpack, and we'll come back to a whole bunch of it. So before you decided or got lucky and had the opportunity to join Goldman, did you always see yourself as being in finance? Like how did that kind of jive with what your intentions were when you were starting your career, and what ultimately kind of attracted you to finance as a career or profession?
You know, I had no exposure to finance as a kid, zero. I mean, I joke that I showed up to an internship in Goldman in their asset management group, not knowing what a mutual fund was. I mean, I had barely taken any finance classes. I had done all of my core liberal arts classes at Notre Dame prior to that. And so, no, I didn't know that I wanted to work in finance or work in investment management in any way. My parents were educators. They were both elementary school teachers. I came from a family in a very blue-collar town called Point Pleasant, New Jersey, where no one in that town was working in finance. It was an amazing place to grow up, but it wasn't on the radar of career choices for me. But I knew I was very attracted to business. I frankly grew up with very humble backgrounds and really wanted to be financially independent. And I went to college with one mandate, and that was to get a good job where I could be financially independent and help my family. And that turned me into business. And then it was about exploring the different nature, like the different academic coursework that was really interesting to me. And exposure to financial markets was extremely exciting. And it all started rolling from there. Talk about a career that wasn't just about, you know, I had a connotation of Wall Street and what that meant. It actually, when I got to Goldman, it wasn't that at all. It wasn't, you know, trading floors and people screaming at each other. It wasn't Wolf of Wall Street. It was this incredible group of smart people working really hard to do great things for their clients. And that it, like, culture of excellence and intellectual stimulation and world markets and economics. It was just, to me, that intellectual stimulation and people connection and really that feeling, like, I'm a competitive person, that feeling of winning on that constant basis kind of spoke to my soul, and I found a lot of purpose in it over the years.
If you can remember, you know, it's so interesting because there's so many parallels to where we are today with this shift, kind of the wave of private wealth that's coming into alts and the education that has to happen. And you mentioned, you know, the private equity university. When you joined Goldman, or even when you joined TPG, kind of what was the rationale? What did Goldman see in wanting to start a private equity business? And then what were kind of some of the things that you were doing to educate investors back then? Was it, you know, the 60-40 portfolio? Was it the benefits of illiquidity? Was it access? I mean, what were the things that you remember resonating in the early days? Because I think there's some parallels to where we are in the markets today in many ways.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, it really for us was spending a lot of time kind of humanizing the asset class for people, in unpacking deals and deal stories that created a connection that all, you know, with the individual allocators to make them realize the special returns that could be created by the asset class. And so this is kind of going, I mean, you kind of go back to the original, you know, KKR stories and RJR Nabisco, and like the original buyouts was what a lot of people associated with private equity asset class. And it was, this isn't just your, you know, your grandfather's, you know, hostile takeover. There is a lot of interesting structures that are taking advantage of investing in companies that can create real value for you that's unique and has a different level, you know, different types of returns. And that there was also just like there was a lot of education around the structure, the liquid nature of the structure, what fees meant, what carry meant. And I do think a lot of that is still applied. Like, when, you know, there are still, you know, work that's being done to unpack the high net worth individual asset base to invest in alternatives because they've largely missed all and like several decades of incredible returns. But, you know, people are still trying to wrestle with the liquidity structure and how do I manage capital calls, and even a little bit lit around like the K-1s and what that means. There's still that education that's going on. And it was those things that we were doing for pension plans back in early 2001. So, and I think today it's still deal stories that hit home. Like, when I think about what makes people attracted to a manager, an asset class, an opportunity set, it is, you know, for Altimeter, telling the snowflake story, like how we knew that was something special when we originally heard about the deal, or how you make the decision to back a company at a certain time, and what that company represents to the consumer and enterprise. Like, people really need to hold on to very tangible anecdotes. It's like investing is so emotional at the end of the day. And that, like, when I think about what we deliver to clients now, like, part of it is investing, but part of it is transparency and insights. Like, part of it is the returns, but they really want to feel connected and to a portfolio.
What is that? We can spend more time talking about some of the specific stories, but what does that mean? Is it connected to the thesis around a specific opportunity? Is it feeling like they have the insight of what's in your head and why you're making the investment? Like, what, how do you think about that connection? Because I think that's fascinating. I mean, as you know, I've spent the majority of my career in commercial real estate, which is different than venture, which is different than kind of traditional, you know, buyout private equity. And so much of the conversation revolves around the relationship. But relationship is such a broad term, right? Relationship, connection, trust. So I'm just curious, like through your lens, what does that mean to you?
Mm-hmm. It means different things. I mean, I think some of it is insights on what is attractive, like it, on the market, what's attractive, how are we thinking about an opportunity set? Like today it's AI, right? You know, how are we unpacking this opportunity set and the emerging opportunities in AI from large language models to applications and everything in between? Translating that back to the people that are investing in us, because they are, that makes them feel a deeper connection to you. It makes them smarter about the other parts of their portfolio. So I think it is around like the opportunity set that you're evaluating. But it's also about the investments that you've made. How did you reach that decision? How did it come to you? Because again, like a lot of it is these connections with people that are investing in you, and they are also investors who are investing their portfolio. And so learning from people who around decision-making, concentration, portfolio construction, like really connecting the dots on how you make the decisions that you make. And then finally, I think it's deal stories. I think people love knowing. I mean, you've probably seen this in real estate where somebody goes by a senior residential community that's branded and in your portfolio, and they like to know, hey, that's in my portfolio. Just that they know they're connected to, you know, they see public market stocks and they know that they've got some exposure to that. It's the same thing in venture. You know, they, you know, what exactly is the underlying portfolio? At Altimeter's side, and we do a lot of stuff in data infrastructure, a lot of enterprise solutions. It's a little bit harder to feel personally connected that versus when I was at TPG and we had investments in Burger King and Neiman Marcus or Cirque du Soleil, you name it. But I think that is, it is a big piece of that, like making the connection of feeling like the tangible investment underneath and understanding, like being able to celebrate the wins on the progress of those investments along the way.
Interesting. So let's go back to your career. So you were at Goldman for what, 9-ish years, 10 years, and then you decided to go to TPG. What prompted you to make the change away from Goldman to TPG? And then during that tenure, you mentioned TPG's assets under management grew exponentially. What, you know, was that obviously a lot of hard work by you and the team raising capital, but kind of what would you attribute some of that success or the growth of AUM to during that period of time?
So the change, I was, you know, 9 years in and I'm now 30 years old and had been largely at one place my entire career. And so I was ready and open for change. I also think I like a small team, and I'm not one, even though it sounds crazy because I worked at Goldman Sachs and TPG, that I like to say that I like a small organization and, you know, not a lot like big bureaucracy or not a lot of layers. And so, but you have to understand the places that I had come from were both super, like Goldman and TPG actually, when I joined, were super entrepreneurial, super flat, really building, like a builder, maybe I'm a builder at heart, you know, really building things from the ground up with a very small, nimble team. And that's what really attracted me. You know, Goldman, we had built out this big infrastructure and we built out this massive team and there were 35 people working for me. And, you know, it was now a big enterprise. And what attracted me to TPG was that, you know, we needed to institutionalize it. It was 40 billion people. There were basically three people that had raised that $40 billion with no infrastructure around clients, around communicating with clients, around, you know, reporting, marketing. It was just incredible work by the team to both find the right investors that can scale, to be super strategic, coupled with the performance of the firm, which had been outstanding. And when you have consistently outstanding performance, the money will come to you. And then, you know, but you got to keep that up. And that's really, really hard for it to keep coming to you that easily. And eventually you do need to build out some infrastructure around it. And so I was really attracted to the opportunity at TPG to be, you know, join a small team that really needed to build and build infrastructure, build strategy, build people. And it was a tremendous 10 years, both with what I think we recruited an outstanding team, some folks who have gone on to do amazing things at other organizations that are now institutionalizing their fundraising practices, and some people that are still there and continuing to scale that organization. I think you asked about like what drove some of the success. You know, I think it was part of it is building product that suits the needs of investors at a given time. And we were one of the first to private credit. We were one of the first to like kind of built out growth equity platform within a large scale organization. We were one of the first to impact. We did a lot of, we built an excellent real estate portfolio that it was different. I mean, it's all anchored in talent, everything around the industry. Like I think a lot of the success came from building very, very talented teams within the organization. And then part of it is really like building product that suits the needs of investors at a given time. So, you know, product market fit is everything. And I think that the firm was very strategic in designing products that could scale and could really meet the needs of investors at the time. Those allocations to those individual strategies were scaling and growing, which is what allowed them to scale so dramatically in the very early days. Like, you know, buyouts, as buyouts were an increasing percentage of an institutional portfolio, credit as it was an emerging asset class in it, private credit as it was emerging asset class in and of its own. So, and I'd like to say it was also process, and that we had a very effective sales team and fundraising infrastructure that also we developed some really tremendous best practices as it related to transparency that helps, but it, you know, kind of need all pieces of that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You should absolutely take credit where credit is due. So I'm glad you fit that in at the end. That's well deserved. So now you're at Altimeter. After a great run at TPG. For our listeners who aren't familiar with Altimeter, maybe give us a bit of an overview of the organization and also talk a little bit about why you made the decision to join Altimeter.
So Altimeter is a technology investment firm. We invest at all stages of tech, from early stage venture through to the public markets. We have a public market hedge fund that invests in a concentrated way in the best of tech. And then we've got a series of venture funds that we're now investing out of our fund 6 today. And so firm is 15 years in and built a tremendous, you know, team and track record under the leadership of our founder, Brad Gerstner, who I think is one of the really special minds in technology investing. And my decision to join Altimeter was really centered around the team. And like, did I really believe that there was a differentiated talent and a unique leader in Brad and the team that he assembled around him to do something really special? You know, the world doesn't need another hedge fund. The world doesn't need another venture fund. But do you have something there that is truly unique and brings something special to investors? And that was kind of the next phase of my career. That's really what I wasn't looking for, a huge scale role. I didn't need to, you know, be at a, you know, a massive company, but I really wanted to build again, but build around great talent.
You know, so talent seems to be a continuous theme. I mean, the other thing that you've mentioned a few times is building. So now that you're in a smaller size organization from a headcount perspective, what does kind of building look like to you? How do you think about your role? What do you touch? What don't you touch? Or do you touch everything because it's a small organization? Talk a little bit about kind of what that looks like in your scope.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So Altimeter has 27 people today. We have about $8 billion of AUM and 27 people. So we really run a very flat, very lean organization. And that really speaks to me because, you know, I think people say in investment management a lot, size is the, like size as in AUM size is the enemy of returns, or scale is the enemy of returns. And we would argue at Altimeter, organizational complexity is the enemy of returns. And I, that's something that I've observed in the world. You know, it's like, how do you stay, keep your investors focused on investing? And so many times as organizations evolve and mature, what happens is the individuals, the great deal people who started those firms, get further and further away from actual deal making and investing because they are so busy managing an organization. And so what building means is at Altimeter is building products that will deliver outstanding returns to investors that can invest in the best of technology, the next great compounders, the companies that are really taking advantage of innovations and phase shifts and super cycles that are happening within technology, but do it in a way where it's, you know, you don't need tons of, and you don't need tons of people to do that, and do it in a way that's very research minded, very focused on investing, and not, and that doesn't necessarily have to come with building massive, massive organization or even massive, massive AUM. You know, in venture is unique dynamic because it's a power law business. So very few deals actually represent the large majority of returns. And so our, you know, cultural North Star is do less, but better. Focus on really the game-changing investments, the more, you know, the more people, the more assets, the more deals you're going to do. And that probably leads you to weighing down the returns of your funds. So those are some of the things we're focused on. And in terms of my role, you know, I like to say that everybody at Altimeter loads the dishwasher, even Brad. And so, you know, it's a small organization. We all do a little bit of everything to make sure the trains are running on time. But my role is really focused on making sure that we are the best partner that we could be to the investors that back us, whatever that means, and making sure that we have the right partners to grow with us over the long term. So that means a kind of understanding the in the global investor base and who would make, you know, over time be a great partner to us.
So much there. I love the saying that the complexity of the org or organizational complexity is the enemy of returns. And I think for our listeners and for you and I who have scaled teams and businesses, I think people understand that oftentimes it's a lot harder to take something away or not do something than it is to just add one more. How do you kind of think about that approach as you think about your team? And my understanding is, you know, you do everything, including load the dishwasher, but capital formation and talent are kind of two areas of focus for you. So how do you think about that discipline of do less and, you know, taking away or not adding? Because it's hard. I mean, it's easy to say, it's hard to do.
It's really hard to do. And I think if it wasn't for Brad's devotion to essentialism, so it is a practice, it's called essentialism. There's an amazing book, folks should read it.
What is the book called? Essentialism?
It's called Essentialism.
Okay, easy enough.
Yep. And that, if you asked anyone of our 27 people, what's the cultural North Star of Altimeter? Essentialism. Like, we live it and breathe it every day. And, you know, it is a constant practice of making sure that you've got simplicity of process. And what does that mean from a my role standpoint, right? It's when we're making a decision on how we're going to communicate with investors, we've got to do it in a scalable way. We've got to make sure that it's like we're communicating very clearly and efficiently and effectively. The answer isn't always more. It's not always more information to share. It's not always more meetings or more events. Like, the answer is like, how do we do this in a way that's smart, that's efficient, and that's highly, highly effective? And I think what reinforces that is we've got, you know, a sole CIO model. The founder of our firm oversees both a public fund and a venture fund with 27 people. So we've got to have him focused on investing. And so my role is like, how do we both make our investors feel like they're connected to our team while keeping the team as focused as they can. And that's a conundrum. And that's something that we really need to force ourselves to think about. So like, what are the tools that we're using to communicate with investors? How can we host events and build our community in ways that are more efficient? And on the talent side, what that means is, and talent for my role is more internal talent management. Sometimes in venture, that means like talent at recruiting for portfolio companies. But I am partnered with Brad to really think about the talent that we have at Altimeter. Not because we're recruiting a lot, you know, in some of that in the recruiting context, not because we're recruiting tons of people, but knowing the landscape of talent. And so that if we ever want to make a change or want to opportunistically add, that we have a very firm view of what excellence looks like at all the various roles at the firm and can make a decision, kind of proactively as opposed to reactive, just via a recruiter and an opportunistic search that you're running from a standing start. And some of that comes to like what we really think about company building in a SEAL Team 6 model as opposed to just a massive team. And so, or Brad will talk about it like where a sports seems to think of that as a basketball team. Like you've got your 5 starters and like if someone gets injured, like who's the team that you got to rotate in? And so it's very different than other organizations that I've worked with, but it's been really interesting and very satisfying from a building standpoint, because I think when you work at a very large organization, it's easy just to take comfort in size and people that will just kind of pick up slack, or even get a little bit slower. And we operate pretty fast paced and there's no hiding.
No hiding. I love that. Maybe this is too in the weeds, but I haven't read the book, so bear with me. But this principle of essentialism, how do you know when you're like, what's the moderator or, you know, the calibration mechanism? How do you know when you have scope creep or you're deviating from the principle of essentialism? Is there a question you ask yourself? Is there kind of a set of heuristics that you use to make decisions? Like, how do you know when you're not on the right track or you're not adhering to the values that you've set forth as an organization?
So the practice is, if it's not an easy yes, it's a no. And that can be applied to investment decisions. It can be applied to organizational decisions. It can be applied to the decision to take a marketing trip that's going to take Brad off the field for a week because we got to travel to, you know, overseas or whatever it means. That is the constant practice. That is the heuristic that we use. And so that helps a lot, right? To have that motion of what do we go to when we're making a key decision. And what that means is that you say no to a lot of good stuff. And Brad tells this anecdote about Steve Jobs, who as himself an essentialism, not, I don't think he used the term essentialism, but he was so maniacally focused in his practice and projects and what they were like, the mission of the organization, what they were trying to achieve. And the anecdote story basically explains that he says, like, how many things have you said yes to? You should be saying no. Like, how many projects are you working on? That sounds like too many. They're all important. Like, you should be saying no to projects that are important. If it feels important, you should still be saying no to keep you focused on the things that really makes you focus on the things that really, really matter and really going to move the ball. So, you know, that's a little bit about the practice, and it's something that is applied across all sides of our business.
I love that. I'm going to read the book. I hope we have a chance to riff on it. I'd love to hear kind of my thoughts and how they juxtapose against the reality of practice. I think it's fascinating. Well, let's switch gears. So one of the things that you've mentioned a few times is that, you know, the way that you think about product, the way that you think about building, the way you think about, you know, value is kind of meeting the needs of investors. Right now, we're recording this in April of 2024, and the world is still somewhat chaotic. The venture markets have been beat up. The public markets have been beat up. We're starting to see kind of the light at the end of the tunnel. Your job is to talk to investors all day, every day, current investors, prospective investors, friends of investors, I'm sure. What do investors want right now from you? And kind of like, what do you need to do or create, or kind of what are some of the big ideas that you're thinking about that drive kind of the strategy of Altimeter to meet their needs?
So I would say there's a lot to navigate for investors to navigate right now that's tricky as it relates to technology, you know, particularly around the advent of AI and the changes that will be brought, the disruption that will be created from the tools and companies that are being developed today. How public market companies, large incumbents play into that, how, you know, what valuations look like, what's the right entry point, is this a bubble? There's so many concerns on investors' minds, and that doesn't just relate into Altimeter. Like, their Altimeter is a place in their portfolio. They're thinking about us and asking these questions because it really informs how they're investing in other parts of their portfolio, from public markets to seed and e-seed investments. It is determining their overall allocation. Like, what do they want their overall allocation to technology in their overall, like, as they look at their overall asset allocation. And so some of what we bring to the table, and I think is really important in the business that we're in, is bringing our insights to them and our views on how we see this unfolding. And I think some other investors do it really well in written form. We have a tendency not to do it through papers or slide presentations. We do it through conversation, through webinars, through the dialogue that we have with our team and some of our investors. We put a lot of it out on Twitter. We put a lot of our thinking out on Twitter. I think that's something unique about Altimeter. Like, you know, it's not enough to say, if you don't want to know what we're thinking, like, you could just go to Twitter. But we do put a lot of our views and insights out there. And that's something that we like to share. So I think that is, that dialogue with investors right now is really critical. I think the other thing that they're really struggling with is, how do I think about the value of the portfolio from that was invested in 20 and 21 and what that is ultimately worth? We're not out of the woods on that yet. So that wasn't just a 2022 question or a 23 question. That's still very much a question today. And we happen to believe that there's a lot that's still being worked out. I think that it's easy to get excited and more positive right now, particularly in venture, because there's capital, new deals being done and new innovation. But, you know, it's not lost on investors that there's a lot that still needs to be worked through.
I mean, investors are smart. They're risk takers, especially if they're investing in venture. But, you know, with the pain in the market and the opportunity that this vintage presents, like, how do you, you know, it seems to me that it's kind of the haves and the have nots. You either have returns or have dry powder to invest, or you don't. And if you don't, you're not able to participate in this vintage. And if you do, you are. I mean, is it more nuanced than that? Like, I mean, I don't know, kind of what are you hearing in like these conversations where you're trying to educate investors on your point of view related to the performance of the markets vis-a-vis kind of historical the last 4 or 5 years?
Don't try to time it. So I don't think that there's any education that we're doing of trying to convince people to be consistent allocations and don't pull back altogether. However, I think the challenge is really around who do I partner with? Okay, I know that I want allocation to this vintage because it is going to be attractive. We're in a drawdown. Valuations have reset. That now should be a more interesting time. Maybe I can't invest as much capital because I don't have as much liquidity in my portfolio, but I want to invest some. Who do I give that capital to? And that's where we're seeing, you know, kind of big swings. And on the GP side, there's a have and have not dynamic going on around kind of things that are in favor and things that aren't. You know, I think a lot of LPs struggling with, how do I think about paper returns versus people that have DPI? How do I think about managers that maybe had one big hit in their portfolio? Like, are they a one-hit wonder? is that something that actually is what you need to achieve in venture because it's a power law business versus consistency of returns? Like, what am I happier with? Is it a consistent 2.5x or is it a 15x fund every once in a while? Like that, those are the types of conversations that were happening, that are happening in venture and are, I think, very unique to that asset class.
And you mentioned earlier, you've got your hedge fund, which is, you know, public, private, and then you have your private kind of venture vehicle. What is the kind of, this is probably a leading question, but like, is that a normal structure to be able to invest in public technology companies and private, or do you tend to see groups that specialize more in, we're just going to do private venture backed, and there's a separate set of investors who will do, you know, hedge fund investors who will do the public stuff? And how do you see that working to your advantage?
Yeah, that's a great question.
And by the way, I asked that, you know, for a whole variety of reasons. One, just curiosity and ignorance in the venture space. And then two, as I relate it back to real estate in some ways, we're starting to see kind of more what I would call special situations, real estate managers who are taking advantage of the massive discounts that are perceived discounts that public REITs and other real estate companies are trading at. And I think there's probably some lessons we can learn from experiences in the venture world and technology world as well.
Yeah. Oh, that's super interesting. I hadn't thought about that in real estate, so I don't spend any time there, but it's fascinating. I should clarify. So there's a venture side and the public side. In the public side, we have a hedge fund and we also have a long vehicle. So that's one point of clarification. But I think our structure is unique. There's very few kind of pure venture, like really truly venture investors that also have a very sizable public vehicle. And really, when you look at our AUM, it's really, and the structure of our team and the activities of the organization, they're split very evenly between venture and public. In fact, in many ways, it really is like one combined pool of opportunities. Yes, they're allocated in specific funds because that's how many investors like to allocate to those asset classes. But really, when you're looking at a venture opportunity, you're looking at what is the return that I can be generated? And is there, could I just, like, one way that essentialism test is, does this really meet the threshold of exceeding what I could allocate to in the public markets today? You know, there are other technology specialists out there. Certainly, we're not the only one. I think the unique thing about Altimeter, I think people, there's a crossover class of investors, you know, and crossover was really, that class of investors really meant to be kind of more exactly what it says, crossing over to the public markets, kind of very late stage. So though we get put, I would say, in, I say same zoo, very different animal, in that we go quite early in the way that we approach venture. To the point of like, what's the benefit of doing public and private? Does that make your life more complicated? Is it more of a distraction? I would say it is not only a differentiator, it's critical to what we do. And that is because the insights that you gather on both sides are informing the decisions that you're making on both sides. So what does that mean? It is, you know, if I'm evaluating a private opportunity to invest in OpenAI or Anthropic or Mistral or any of these large language models, I need to understand, you know, is Meta just going to build Llama 3 and open source it? And is that going to disrupt the whole thing? What is Google doing? And let me give you a flip, like, and on the flip side, you're thinking about the same thing. Like, you know, is Perplexity going to, you know, be the portal to search and discovery? How is that going to impact Google? What does that mean for their earnings? Like ByteDance versus Meta and the Reels product. Like ByteDance is in a private market context, Meta's public. So there's these insights that you can gather on both sides that are super helpful.
When you say it like that, it sounds so obvious and so simple. Yet I am sure under the hood, it's not nearly that simple, but I think it makes a lot of sense. So on that kind of note, I'm curious, you know, we don't have time to unpack every major technology trend, and you've rattled off a lot of companies, I think some of which you have positions in and, you know, maybe others that you're tracking. Kind of what are your kind of big ideas right now? So imagine which I am, you know, a relative novice when it comes to technology investing. You're meeting with a potential investor for the first time. You're trying to just educate them on, you know, super high level trends that we're seeing. Like, how would you kind of explain the state of the market right now and maybe kind of two or three big bets or best ideas that you're exploring over the next, call it 12 to 18 months?
Yeah. And look, we cover a lot in technologies from private to VC. And so, you know, maybe we can take a step back and kind of just look at it on a higher level. And I would maybe talk about kind of two topics. One, like, and this is your allocation to technology. You know, technology has grown to 5% of GDP 10 or 15 years ago to 14% of GDP today. I'm not sure of the exact, I'm going to get the exact stat wrong, but it's, the growth has been incredible. And the question is, do you believe that technology will represent more of GDP in the future? And do you believe that technology companies will outperform non-technology companies because of their ability to both scale and leverage AI to be more efficient and manage the bottom line? Like, some of those basic principles, I think, are universally agreed and really help you orient to, do I want more exposure to tech? Okay, that's one side of it, kind of the macro level. The other macro level is, and I think this is universally agreed, we are at the advent of a new super cycle in technology. And what do I mean by super cycles? Is it kind of phase shifts, emerging innovations that are coupled with major secular shifts on how we operate as humanity that create massive opportunities for companies to compound faster for longer? When have we seen this happen? The advent of the internet was a super cycle. Social mobile was a super cycle. All data moving to the cloud is a super cycle. And now we have the AI super cycle. And in each of those periods of time, you had unique opportunity, like companies that were developed from a standing start that really changed, you know, were disruptive and created massive value creation for investors. And so, you know, and AI is unique because of the role that public companies can play in that today. And that's like the whole separate deep dive. But so I set that stage to say, like, what are the interesting opportunity sets? Like, if you think about AI, data times compute equals AI. Like, all data moves to the cloud, so intelligent applications can take advantage of that data. You know, early days for Brad is like internet, then social mobile. So data moving to the cloud, like modern data stack, how enterprises manage their data, all of that, that is really interesting to us and is still interesting to us in the age of AI. And then in AI, it's making sure that you're in a position to see all the interesting disruptors, that you're in the position to win and have access to these deals. And that's the, you know, in Silicon Valley, like, that's the nature of venture. It's not just identifying the opportunity. The founders choose you and you've got to win, and it's very competitive. And so are you in the small club investors that accesses the best deals? And are you in a position, like, why do founders choose you?
Fascinating. Yeah. I think it's, you know, we see the headlines. We've all seen, you know, the exponential growth of some of the public companies and obviously a lot of the innovation coming out, but I think we're just scratching the surface. So we have just a few minutes left. I want to touch on two quick topics in the last kind of five-ish minutes or so. One, you mentioned Twitter or X. You know, you're very active there. For anyone who doesn't follow you, they should. And maybe just kind of, what is the role that plays in your kind of professional, personal identity building creation? Like, in a lot of professional circles, you know, I don't know how many of your former colleagues at Goldman are actively using Twitter X every day. It seems still somewhat counterculture, although for those of us who are on it, we know that there's a lot of insight. So maybe just give us a quick overview of, you know, how you think about it as a tool or utility and how others can benefit from some of the things that you've gained.
You know, this has been an interesting learning experience for me over the last 2.5 years of kind of emerging, like being an emerging contributor on X and actually putting myself out there from a brand standpoint, outside of just a kind of a passive LinkedIn contributor or a, you know, kind of more of a voyeur on X than anything else. And that came from, like, that is one of the, you know, a big, I would say a cultural element of Altimeter is sharing your insights out loud, you know, testing your thoughts in the court of public opinion in a subject matter that you know about. Everyone at Altimeter is an expert in something. And, you know, that is what, how Brad put it to me when I was first joining, when he said to me, look, we had decided that I was joining the firm. And they said, you know, there's one other thing. Speaking spontaneously out loud in a public context is not something that is universally accepted, encouraged. In fact, it's quite the opposite. And so, you know, and we're putting ourselves out there, not from Altimeter. We're not speaking on behalf of Altimeter, but just speaking as you, as an observer of markets, as like an expert in whatever it is that you do. And he just said, look, like, I think it's important for you just to be there. Also, the venture community is on X. Like, that is where the venture community is. That is the founder community. It's the innovator community. A lot of, you know, the players in our ecosystem, the founders and the funders, they are there. And so I want you to have a voice there. And I said, look, I am a mom of two kids. I am like pushing it. Like, I'm so busy. I like having to think of something interesting to say is really challenging. And so the way that I figured out how to do it is just do it weekly, once weekly, and do it on Saturday mornings, because that's usually when I'm kind of watching my kids play sports or doing something where I have a little bit of downtime. And so that's how it all evolved for me, was like a weekly tweet on what I'm hearing from the ecosystem. And I have been shocked at how rewarding that has been and how engaging it has been from GPs and from LPs and from other folks just around the ecosystem that enjoy in talking about the LP part of our work. I think the deal stuff has been out there for a long time. Like, people have been talking about funds and GPs that are raising things and doing things, but actually sharing the LP perspective or mindset is, it was just kind of a more of a black box. And I love that I see more people talking about that now, because I think if people understand the customer base of alternatives, it will lead to better outcomes, better products, more transparency, serving clients in a better way. And so it's fun for me to see how it's evolving and that it's becoming a part of, you know, I think a part of the, you know, the venture chatter now also involves the LP side of things.
I love it. And yeah, the heard from the VC LPs this week topic is a great one. So we'll link to your Twitter handle or X handle in the show notes, and hopefully people will follow along. I know I've enjoyed the journey. On the last thing, and I know we're just about out of time here, is, you know, I'm curious to know what advice, you know, you would give to young people, but specifically women looking to enter alternatives. You've been an advocate and an ally and a strong promoter of more women, more gender diversity in alts. It's a big need and an opportunity. And so if someone's listening and they're kind of wondering, how do I become like Megan? You know, what advice would you give to people as they're navigating their career journey, specifically women?
I think my advice really is to follow and make decisions to... So, and it sounds so basic, right? It's a follow your heart and make career decisions that really speak to your soul and what really resonates with you from a curiosity standpoint, from an intellectual standpoint, not just what you think you should be doing as a next step. And I see so many people in their early career, and this is not specific to women. I think it's really specific to high performers who do all the right things to get them into the right college, and then they get the right job, and then they just follow these series of steps of things that they're supposed to, they think they're supposed to do to be successful. And I think the most successful people that I see that for women are still in the game, like, it's hard. It's hard for everybody. But I think when you introduce the complexities of having children and, you know, in this industry that is incredibly demanding, not to overgeneralize, that could be for anyone, not just women, but like it gets hard. And the women that are in it, that are super successful, that are, you know, driving hard, they just love it. They just love what they do. And so just, you know, love what you do. That it's like, doesn't that sound so lame? is that what everybody says? But it just comes down to that.
It does, but it sounds so perfect and it's so appropriate. Just follow what you love. And I think that's a great way to wrap up this episode, Megan. It's been a pleasure to chat with you. I appreciate you sharing your insights and I look forward to following you on X and continuing to follow the Altimeter journey and your journey. Thanks for joining me today.
Brandon, thank you so much for having this conversation. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to www.linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff. Or you can find me on Twitter at B Sedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.